trusted this girl, this criminal. Perhaps that's rich, coming from me. But there's a world of difference between our two deceptions. I needed her help for the sake of our whole world. I had to put the work I'm here to do above anyone's needs, including my own. And even if that excuse wasn't enough, and perhaps it wasn't, I promised myself that despite the lie that brought her to this temple with me, I'd find a way to get her the money she needed. She, on the other hand, threw me to the wolves the first chance she got, and then did it again. I can't believe I made a fool of myself over her, liking her, admiring her, even... God, I'm such an idiot. She threw my name at them like a shield, like a bribe. If Liz hadn't already known who I was, that would have sealed my fate. I've let everyone down. Charlotte, who believed I could do this, who argued on my behalf to convince Global Energy to back me and spend unthinkable amounts of money to smuggle me here, who bet her career that I could bring back enough information to help her keep her job and prove my father right. My father. My eyes burn. I went against his wishes in coming here, or what his wishes would have been if he'd known what I was planning. I've helped a looter find her way into the heart of this temple, and I let her distract me enough that I lost sight of what I came here to do. All I can think of right now is my father, imprisoned as surely as I am. And he's not some cardboard cutout of an academic, an imaginary man standing up for a highbrow ethical argument. He's my dad. He's my dad who forgets his coat on the way out the door when he has an idea, who daydreams until he falls asleep on the couch, his cup of tea cold by his side, who still turns to talk to my mother, even though she hasn't been there in over a year. He's alone, stubbornly, desperately holding out against pressure from the IA and the world, worrying about me, about what will happen while he's locked away and powerless. I'm all he has, and I've let him down. But I have to stay alive if I want any chance of rectifying that. So I force my mind back to the hallway in front of me. So far, we haven't hit another puzzle like the musical bridge, just simple instructions to be decoded in order to avoid traps. Keep to the right-hand side of the room, step only on the dark stones, that sort of thing. I've spotted the Nautilus symbol tucked away in corners or up high, scratched as if nobody was meant to see it. Each time it has a line radiating from it on a slightly different angle. Each time I've taken a picture. Last night I sat with my journal, drawing the spiral over and over again, and inventing and dismissing ciphers to explain the seemingly random lines radiating outward. I didn't get anywhere. On the upside, the thugs behind me are taking my instructions a little more seriously since one of them, Alex, I think, took off his pack to hunt for a snack while I thought, and let its weight ease onto an unmarked stone. 16 razor-sharp spikes in a 4x4 grid shot up from the stone his pack was resting on, sliding into it like a knife through warm butter. So now Alex's belongings are nicely aerated, and everyone's listening more carefully. I've been translating for what feels like hours, while trying to force my tired brain to think its way out of this. But I can barely concentrate on the glyphs, something that's usually second nature to me, let alone think strategically. When the toe of my boot catches on a loose flagstone, and I nearly fall into the next room before I've had the chance to read the instructions, Liz calls for a halt. We're in a wide hallway between chambers, and it's as safe a place as any. I sink down to a crouch, leaning my back against the wall, lifting my bound wrists so I can scratch my jaw. The bindings aren't helping with my balance, but apparently they're non-negotiable. Javier crouches down in front of me to check my circulation and loosen my bonds a little, and hand me a few crackers and a hunk of cheese from my own supplies. I make myself chew and swallow, resting my aching head against the cool stone behind me, and try to make myself think. It's going to be the devil's own work getting out of here, climbing back up cliffs and jumping over crumbled rock. It can be done, but with pursuit on my tail, and without Mia's climbing expertise. It's going to take almost as much brain work to get out of here as it did to get in. I'm counting on Liz thinking the same way, and keeping me alive long enough to navigate them out of this place once they've looted whatever's at the center. But I know that as soon as we're out, my usefulness drops to nothing. Come to that, I don't even know what we'll find at the middle of this temple. The answer to my Nautilus puzzle, certainly. But tech? Valuable loot? I honestly don't know. She might lose her temper before it's time to exit, if I'm unlucky. If I'm going to survive this, I need to think about ways to even the odds. It's not just my father depending on me, but, if his theories are right, potentially the rest of humanity as well. I can't afford to stop fighting. I can't afford to shout my hurt at Amelia for her betrayal, or throw my life away in some stupid lunge for freedom, because if I get shot, there's no one else. I have to think. And I have to be prepared to act. A moment later, the fourth guy, who they've been calling MC, in my head it's because of the bushy black mutton chops visible below the edge of his hat, is hauling me to my feet. Soon we're underway once more, the stone passage ahead lit by our head torches. I'm out in front, trained lab rat that I am, and Amelia's walking back with the rest of them, her hands now unbound, though she's flanked by Javier and Alex. It pleases me that they don't quite trust her, and it kills me that they're right in believing that however badly she's betrayed me, I don't think I can bring myself to abandon her to the mercies of this place, knowing what it will mean. Clearly they think she'll work as collateral to ensure my good behavior. And they're right. As we arrive in the next chamber, it's immediately obvious it's another grand puzzle, rather than a simple set of instructions. Warning glyphs parade across the ceiling and cover the walls, and the floor is a complex but very deliberate pattern of stone pavers, many of them carved as well. I angle my wrist up to snap a Nautilus carving half hidden in the shadows, etched over the doorway on the far end of the field of pavers. Crystalline stone glints back at me as I shine my head torch over the floor, and when I look up, I can see hints of cables up in the dark recesses of the ceiling high above us. Metallic veins dance through the stone of the walls, and everywhere I look, there's more to take in. I stop in place, staring, my heart sinking. This looks impossible.
Well?
Liz says behind me, impatient. This will take a while, I reply, and though she growls under her breath, when she walks up to take a look over my shoulder, evidently the sight before her satisfies her that I'm not stalling for time. They set up lights so I can see the whole cavern, and sit down for another round of snacks while I work. A tiny part of me, the very small part that's not preoccupied with either trying not to die or dreaming up exotic, impossible plans for revenge, wishes I could film every section of this cavern, preserve every glyph and every stone for study. Beyond his warning about the Nautilus, about what the glyph beside it meant, catastrophe, apocalypse, the end of all things. My father spent endless hours trying to argue with the International Alliance about the sheer value of exploration, the infinite possibilities afforded by the opportunity to study such an ancient and vast civilization. It's a conversation he and I have had many times. The first time I remember it was when I was 12. It was my school holidays, and he and I had joined an expedition in Spain from the University of Valencia. My father's friend Miguel headed it up, and to me, he was the king of all he surveyed. We were excavating a series of centuries-old homes near the university itself, recently, and briefly, uncovered due to some building works there. In the gap between demolition and construction, the archaeologists had swarmed in. Miguel and my father let me assist a couple of the grad students, and when I got back to our hotel that first night, I was brimming with things to tell him. I swiped through picture after picture on my phone, filling him in on every artifact we'd uncovered, parroting what I'd learned about which museums might want them and what they were worth. He listened and he nodded, and when he spoke, he said the last thing I expected to hear. "That's a long list, Jules, but what did you learn today?" I remember the feeling as if it happened just moments ago. The way the ground slipped beneath my feet, and suddenly I was uncertain. I'd done something wrong, but I didn't know what. I glanced down at my phone, with its catalogue of pictures, silent. "Each one of these pieces will play an important part in a museum," he said, his voice gentle. "But together, they tell a story that's even more important. Look here, at these things you all found in the bedroom. I see 5 different hair combs. What does that tell us about the person who lived in this room?" "They were probably rich," I ventured. "Or they cared a lot about doing their hair." "Or both," he agreed with a smile. "Let's look at what else is here and see what kind of story we can build. You never know what we'll find out." And I couldn't have imagined how much we would find. We were up until well after midnight, constructing stories about the people who might have lived in that house, learning about them, viewing them through first one lens and then another. Without that late night, we'd never have discovered that the home we were excavating belonged to a 15th century poet still studied today. Other scholars would never have found new interpretations for his works, knowing where he'd lived. We'd never have seen the beauty of his work refracted back at us, or learned more than we knew before about the world he inhabited, which taught us in turn about the world we inhabited. "Humans exceed themselves when they open their minds to discovery," my father said that first night. "When we immerse ourselves in the wonders of curiosity, rather than moving straight toward the goal we've chosen, toward the goal we imagine is most important because it's the one we can see, when we allow ourselves to explore, we discover destinations that were never on our map." My father changed the way I saw the world that night. That night was the reason I understood when he called for the exploration of Gaia to slow down, even before we found the hidden warning, the Nautilus spiral. I still wonder how everything might have unfolded, how our lives might be different, if even a handful of the officials at the IA had ever had an experience like that night in Valencia. My father and I dreamed for years of exploring a room like the one laid out before me. But now I don't get the luxury of exploration, because I have to pour all my efforts into survival. Which is exactly what the International Alliance has been doing on Earth, focusing on the immediacy of saving lives, theirs and the rest of humanity. After years of arguing against my father's critics, now I sound just like them. So I take what photographs I can manage and start to read. The problem with reading conceptual glyphs, signs and signals that don't mean any one particular word, but change in relationship to one another, is that you have to read the whole inscription and hold it in your head in order to translate it. And I have no idea where to start. So I let my eyes run over the glyphs, consider their various meanings, and wait for the pattern to emerge. I really wish I had my father's gift for mathematics around now, or Amelia's, come to that. The puzzle is something to do with time, I realize after a while. The glyphs are talking about the nature of time. I think they're saying that it's linear, that one can go forward or back along it, like a road. But that makes no sense. Then again, they're aliens, and I'm lucky they conceive of time in a manner that makes any sense to me at all. They might be talking about literally moving forward or back in time, but more likely they're talking about something abstract, like imagining the future or remembering the past. I can't travel back in time, but I want to. I want to go back to the moments I trusted Mia. I want to go back to smiling at her across our campfire. I want to go back to not knowing just how far she'll go, who she'll betray to get her money. I step out onto the first stone, feeling the attention behind me focus as I start to move. "Don't follow yet," I say, holding up my bound hands to signal they should stop. "I might need to back up quickly if I get this wrong." The first few puzzles are simple, repeats of those I've already seen. Step to the left here, stand on the dark stone, tap this one with your foot before transferring your weight to it. And then I'm staring down at a familiar curve, my eyes widening. I've seen this before too, but it's not a glyph. This is the graph Mia deciphered, the key to tuning the pipes and the bridge that opened that immovable door. Why is it here again? There's no wind here this time, no music, but it is a puzzle that lies in my immediate past, just as the instructions I've seen so far have been repeats. In a flash, I understand what this room is. A journey through time, from behind us to in front of us. Though how I'm meant to understand puzzles I haven't come across yet, in the future, I don't know. But I can start with what I do know. Maybe the rest will become clear. Or I'll figure out a way to run. "I need Amelia and a bottle of water," I call over my shoulder. I can hear the frost in my voice, and I'd like to drop it a couple of degrees further, use her surname, rather than the intimacy of her first name. But I'm realizing I can't call for Ms. anything, because I don't have any idea what her last name is. There's a lot I don't know about her. Hell, how can I be sure I know anything about her at all?
"What do you want her for?"
Liz calls from the entrance behind me.
"It's referencing the first puzzle," I say. "She helped me unlock it. I can't do it on my own."
There's quiet consultation behind me, a murmur of voices I can't make out, and then footsteps. Amelia carefully makes her way across the stones I've locked into place, fetching up beside me. Her hands are still free, and she holds a water bottle in one.
"We have weapons trained on you," Liz calls out. "Careful, Amelia. Wouldn't want your sister to come to any grief without you, would we?"
I can only assume Liz is one of those people who think that I'm a genius in one area of my life and an idiot in every other. But now, I'm not going to hear the way she leans on the word sister like she's putting it in quotation marks. My anger is like a visceral thing, heavy in my chest, closing my throat. The sister I silently promised myself I'd find a way to help. The sister Amelia offered me as a look at the deepest part of herself. The sister that sealed her lie. The sister that doesn't exist.
"Got it,"
Amelia calls back, her voice tight, without looking up. Instead, she looks straight ahead, so that I can hear her, but Liz can't see her mouth move.
"Jules," she murmurs. "I'm doing this to keep us safe."
I snort, though I keep my voice down, indignation surging up.
"Us? I'm already safe. They need me. And I was still ready to try and keep you safe. But you've thrown me to the wolves twice now, and you're standing free with them while I'm at gunpoint. I hope you'll forgive me if I'm not too sympathetic to your needs right now."
Her jaw squares, but her voice stays low.
"You have every right to think that, but I promise I won't abandon you. I know what it's like to be the only person who can help someone you love." "Do you?"
My tone is pointed,
and makes her already large eyes widen even more.
Don't, I think, anger tensing my muscles. Don't pretend to be shocked or hurt. Don't look at me like we're friends.
Before Amelia can muster a response, Liz's voice cuts across the space between us once more.
Enough chit-chat, kids. Let's get moving, if you already know how to complete this section.
The frustration that's been simmering inside me breaks like a wave, tumbling me over and submerging me.
Listen, I snap. If you want this done, either do it yourself, or bloody well wait until I'm ready. If you want to bring the ceiling down on us all, which is what one wrong step will do, then just get on with it.
There's no response from behind us, but I have no doubt I've just earned myself some manner of punishment. A meal lost, a kick to the ribs. It's worth it. No doubt they're looking up at the shadowy cables and glints of metal above us, impossible to make out in the darkness, and drawing the conclusion that that's a lot of ceiling to land on top of anyone. Perhaps they'll give me a little room to concentrate now. I point out the curve to Amelia, who understands straight away. The next 5 stones have holes in them, and she's careful to fill each one with the same fraction of water she used in that first puzzle. The next few pavers click into place, and together we step forward onto them. Behind us, a couple of the thugs raise a cheer for the progress, then fall abruptly silent as Liz snaps something. Mia tilts her gaze up and sideways at me, her mouth curving to a smile. And for a moment, I wonder if one really can go forward and back in time, just as this room seems to suggest. Because just for an instant, I'm traveling back to that moment I wished for, when we trusted one another, when we worked together without doubt. And then that moment's gone, and I'm translating the next paver, stepping forward onto it. Amelia stays beside me, and nobody calls her back yet, though I know the guns are still trained on us. I take a long swig from the water bottle, because I'm thirsty, and not feeling particularly motivated to conserve the supplies of my allies, earning a growled warning from Liz. We make it another 6 pavers, a good 2/3 of the way across the hall, before we arrive at the next major puzzle. And immediately I know we're in trouble. Mahercule, I mutter, lifting my bound hands to run them through my hair.
Jules?
Mia whispers, before Liz cottons onto the fact that I've stopped for too long. I think this is from the puzzle that had already collapsed, the cliff we climbed down, I murmur. It only takes a second for the implication of that to register on her face, as her mouth falls open. We never solved this puzzle, which means we have no idea how to solve it now. And if we try, there's a decent chance we're going to bring this whole thing down on our heads.
So, if we mess this up, she whispers.
I nod fractionally, rolling my eyes up to the ceiling above us. Most of it's hidden in the darkness, but there can be no doubt that the designers of this room paid some very serious attention to that ceiling. Cables glint, seeming to move and sway for a moment in the shaking light of my head torch. Mia swallows hard.
Problem, sweetheart!
Liz shouts across the space between us. By silent agreement, we ignore her.
Keep thinking, Mia whispers. Look at the whole picture. Maybe there's something.
Alex, get out there,
Liz snaps, when neither of us reply.
Bring the girl back.
The next few seconds slow to a snail's pace, as my mind flips through 1,000 thoughts, one after another. The short blonde thug, Alex, is stepping out onto the path I've locked into place behind us. We've only got a few moments before he'll drag Mia back to the others and leave me out here alone. For those few moments, until he reaches us, he's walking across a literal death trap. He's vulnerable. Vulnerable.
It's a simple word, and it avoids the unthinkable reality of what that could mean. This is my chance to improve the odds against me. This is my chance to take one of them out. Another second ticks past. This isn't just about my survival. This is about my father. About the danger of the undying tech and the chance to prove it. The future of my planet. Our planet. Mia, I whisper, head down, looking sideways at her. She turns her head properly now, hesitating, looking back at me. She's tired and dirty, and her eyes are scared, and she looks lonely, and it makes my throat tighten. I wish I knew if she were playing me, sticking with whichever side she thinks will get her further. I know I want to believe. I know she stopped and helped me before she knew I could offer her anything. I know I'm furious she sold me out to these criminals. But whatever she's done, she doesn't deserve to die. I won't be a part of that. I draw a shaky breath. Do you trust me? Another second slips away as I scan her features, drinking them in. Silently, she rests one of her hands on my bound ones, giving me her answer in the squeeze of her fingers through mine. I squeeze back, the only warning before I'm gathering myself to move.
Run!
Together we sprint for the archway ahead of us, for safety. In the same instant, there's a thunderous roar above us as the ceiling starts to give way, a rock ricocheting off my shoulder and knocking me off balance. I stumble forward, nearly losing my footing, and Mia shoves her shoulder into mine without breaking stride to knock me back upright. In the next instant, the floor's giving way beneath us.
Perfetuity, we're screwed. I didn't see any glyphs about the floor.
I missed one detail, and that's what's going to kill us. It wasn't just the ceiling that was rigged, but the floors as well. We're leaping from stone to stone as they drop away beneath us, momentum sending us flying towards safety, but not fast enough. Not fast enough. Somehow Mia has her multi-tool in her hand, and we're just a few steps from safety, and we're not going to make it. The final stone drops out from beneath me, and I throw myself toward the archway that's suddenly a ledge above me as I fall. I've miscalculated. This is my fault. This is it. When Mia suddenly punches her hand between my bound wrists, driving the multi-tool into the rock face. The ropes around my wrists snag on it, and my arms are on fire, my shoulders screaming as I'm jerked up short, the floor gone from beneath me, the ceiling still raining down, hanging from the knife wedged into the rock. Her momentum carries her down, down, and my heart stopping, and I can't do anything. And then she manages to grab at one of my legs, sending a bolt of agony through my shoulders at the extra weight. I can't stop myself from crying out, but there's as much relief in it as pain. She doesn't even pause to acknowledge the fact that she nearly plunged to her death and scrambles up my body, climbing me like a ladder. As soon as she's on the ledge, she spins around to reach for my arms. She's too small to pull me up, too light, and my weight drags her toward the edge of the cliff. I kick wildly, my boot finding a tiny ledge, and I jam my foot onto it, scrabbling upward as a chunk of rock from above plummets past my head. Then somehow I'm over the edge of the cliff, and we're safe together in the archway, lying in a tangle of limbs as she reaches past me to yank the multi-tool out of the rock. The ceiling is still falling, and soon the room we've just come through will be packed solid with fallen rocks. And somewhere in there, Alex is dead. We're safe on the other side, separated from Liz, her remaining men, and most of our gear, but we're alive. And then it really hits. Alex is dead, and I killed him. In all likelihood, I'm the first murderer on Gaia. Take one of them out, I thought to myself. Murder one of them. That's what I meant. I dodged the word. I can't dodge the deed. I crawl free of Mia, propping up on my elbows and knees, and my coughing turns to retching, my skin ice cold, damp with sweat. Wordlessly, Mia eases my arms to one side, so she can get at the ropes binding me. It takes her 3 tries to cut me free, her hands shaking so badly her fingers won't work.
We should keep moving.
Her voice is shaking too, and I don't think I can look at her, or I'll lose what little remnant of calm I have left.
Liz won't give up. We need a head start.
A man is dead. Liz is on our heels, angrier than ever. And I'm trapped on the wrong side of a rockfall with an uncertain ally. Did she save me because she still needs me? Or... I'm not even sure of the end of that sentence. As we climb to our feet, the questions racing around my head are pounding as hard as my pulse.
Chapter 11. Amelia. I lead the way for a while. Not every room in this place is a puzzle requiring Jules's expertise. And while I can't read the glyphs, I am starting to know what their patterns indicate. Like Jules said, the glyphs are based on math, and once I started to recognize the equation for their language, their simpler instructions, step here, don't walk there, aren't hard to translate. And the spread of ordinary traps like hidden spikes and pitfalls are becoming easy to spot and avoid. It's almost like the Undying put them there so we can see them and know we're still on the right path. Maybe it says something about me that the easier it gets, the more uneasy I feel. Like even an ancient race that died out before humans used tools could somehow be out to get me. "This doesn't bother you," I say to Jules, shattering the silence. "What?" His voice comes from behind me, distracted. "It's like they're playing with us," I say. "This part is so easy." "Maybe," he replies, sounding tired, an edge to his voice. I don't know if it's frustration with my continued suspicion, or if it's this new barrier that's formed between us, or both. But we can't assume they were anything like us, Amelia, or that they were putting in these tests simply to torture us. They weren't human. There's no reason to think they'd understand the kind of cruelty we're capable of. He only calls me Amelia when he's being formal, or when he's annoyed. Otherwise, it's Mia, his accent leaning into the vowels. Cruelty, I think, feeling sick, and I fall silent once again. I tell myself that I'm leading to test myself, to make sure that I've got some chance of getting through this place alive without Jules, if he decides I can't be trusted after all. But the truth is that I'm walking in front so that I don't have to look at him. He's so tired, so ragged, and so changed. That trusting nature of his, the one I scoffed at and predicted would get him killed, it's gone. When I look at him, I can see it in his posture, his body language. That slight scholarly stoop to his shoulders now looks like he's carrying the weight of the entire cave-in that killed that man. Of course, with him behind me, it means I can feel his eyes boring into me. Or I imagine I can, anyway. Despite the warmth of his hand as we ran for the edge of the last puzzle, despite his nod when I suggested we keep moving, all I can see in my mind's eye is that burning look of his last night as I lay down with Liz's gang, and he stayed tied to a rock, barely able to move. When everything we'd built started to crumble, beneath the laughter over my imaginary sister. You don't owe him, my mind insists, flashing frame after frame from the moment he admitted he'd lied to me so I would help him, so I'd get him to this temple for his altruistic dreams. There's nothing to explain. And even if I wanted to explain, we don't have the time to stop. We're moving. That's enough. My feet feel unsteady, and it's not just exhaustion making my legs shake. For all my swagger, for all the time I've spent scavenging in the ruins with murderers and thieves, I've never actually seen someone die. And true, I didn't see that guy, Alex, Liz called him, die either, or even hear him scream. A part of me insists that maybe he survived. Maybe he leapt out of the way back toward the safety of the other side of the puzzle, even as Jules and I ran for it. But we were closer to the edge than he was. And thanks to Jules, we were ready. And we only barely made it. That guy is dead. I want desperately to stop, turn, grab for Jules' hand, and pull him in against me just to feel his warmth. Despite the fact that I hate him for his lie, for dooming me and Evie, for the crimes of his father, for all of it. But it already feels like centuries ago that he slipped that arm around my waist in our sleep, and it was all I could feel for an instant before Liz's flashlight brought reality crashing in. I know there was a chemistry between us, and I think he knew it too. But we're too different, and there have been too many lies now. Though it was for all of a second, I missed the feel of his arm around me. I'd been keeping myself apart from him, this boy who's so goddamn brilliant and so goddamn naive all at once. This boy who's both the best possible candidate to make it to the center of this temple, and also the most likely to stride into danger with no idea what he's doing. I've kept that distance there on purpose, because my sister comes first. And when it comes down to it, I've known there might come a moment when I'd have to choose between her and Jules. And it has to be Evie. It always has to be Evie. It's me and Evie heading for our Amsterdam. And then everyone else, the people who don't matter. But that night, his arm around me, my head tucked under his chin. For the first time, and not just since landing on Gaia, I wasn't alone. Just like Evie wished. I mean, when all's said and done, we've only known each other a few days. And what we don't know about each other far outweighs the stories we've told so far. But there's something about him. I can sense the potential of what we could be together, as a team, or more. And I know that for a while, he did too. I wish I could tell him that. Our trust's so badly damaged now that he wouldn't believe me. I don't know if he believes anything I've told him was the truth. But that night, we were a we. And now that I'm a me again, I feel lonelier than ever. I'm forced to set all these thoughts aside when we come to an archway signaling one of the rooms with the larger, more complex puzzles. And as Jules comes up beside me, we shine our lights in to size up the challenge ahead. The huge chamber seems empty, but each of the paving stones has something carved on it, and I can guess the nature of the puzzle easily enough. Step on the right stones, you make it through. Step on the wrong ones, you don't. Jules must be thinking of Liz behind us, and perhaps of Alex. But he takes his time, studying each one of them in turn, frowning. "These aren't glyphs," he says eventually, and when I look down, I realize he's right. I had just assumed, but now I study them. They lack the mathematical precision of the glyphs, the patterns that I'm starting to recognize. This writing is something entirely different. My heart sinks, We don't have time for Jules to teach himself a whole new language to get us across the room. I crane my neck up, checking the roof, trying to pull together a backup plan. Perhaps there's a way we can climb, get around the puzzle somehow. I don't like our chances. We're both exhausted, and we've hardly got any equipment left. There are patterns, Jules says eventually, very slowly, like he's trying the idea out. He lifts a hand to point to the rows of characters as they stretch away. See how they change a little, the letters? And the words, for want of something better to call them. I see, I agree. If we can't read them, does the pattern help? They could say anything. They might not mean anything at all, he admits. Human brains look for patterns everywhere. It's how we're wired. That doesn't mean it's how the undying see things. I make myself stay quiet, trying not to hurry him along as he works through it, mentally giving him about 10 seconds more in lecture mode before I cave. They heard music the same way we do, I point out. They made us harmonize to cross the bridge. So perhaps we should assume it's a deliberate pattern. I mean, if it's not, we don't have any other options. And we're in a lot of trouble. So you might as well hope it is. Agreed, he says, still staring down at the floor. Look here. Do you see how there's one dot, and beside it, there's these three? I'm going to call them words, though they're not any language I've ever seen. They might not be a language at all. They might just be for the puzzle. Yes, I say, forcing myself to be patient. A dot. And then there's two dots, he says, pointing at the next stone along. And then these three words again. Are we counting dots? I try, squinting at the stones past the first two. Most of them seem to have one dot, or two, sometimes three, and then the list of words beside them. I think... He falls silent again. As I try not to scream and dig my nails into my palms... And wait. Eventually, I'm rewarded when he speaks again. I'm trying to think what I'd notice about these words if they were in English, or French, or Chinese, or something I speak, he murmurs. How do they change from when they're beside one dot to when they're beside two? Because they're quite similar otherwise. I think it's... Abruptly, he trails off, nodding slowly. Jules, I prompt. Conjugation, he says, breathing the word like it's a prayer. It's like verbs. You know the way a verb changes? I run, she runs, or in some languages, it changes even more dramatically. Think of French. J'ai. Tu as, elle a, nous avons, and so on. If you say so, I agree. And he snaps out of lecture mode, returning to something more useful. The undying handle verbs the same way we do, in some cases. It changes, depending on whether it's I, you, we, and so on. I think this is a nonsense language that uses that sort of pattern, and we have to learn it. We're having a grammar lesson right now? The urge to laugh bubbles up inside me, and I clamp down on it. I think if I start, I might not stop. Yes, he says, more enthusiastic than I am. The ones with the one dot, they're I run. And the ones with two dots, they're someone else, second person, you run. 3, third person. She runs. So all we have to do is learn the endings for each, and then step on the stones with the correct ones. When we see 3 dots, step on a stone with the third person ending. Easy as that, I murmur. I follow his gaze as he traces out the pattern he's found. The series of words with endings that change. We find it once, then twice, and once we're sure enough, we step out onto the paving stones, making our choices for each stone with 1 dot or 2. Every nerve in my body is jangling, but there's no grinding, no sudden crack. The floor beneath us holds steady, and one by one we find each new word, work out how it should conjugate, and step across those stones. It's almost like a mathematical puzzle, once I get the hang of it. When we reach the other side, I let out a breath, leaning against the arch of the doorway and glancing back. Our footsteps mark a clear path to follow in the dust, if Liz and her crew get past the rockfall. But there's nothing we can do to hide our trail without potentially setting off whatever fatal traps lie in this room to punish mistakes. We're quiet as we keep moving down the endless mazes and corridors. The next few rooms are far simpler. We come to a puzzle with square blocks of stone to be transferred back and forth between different pavers until their combined weights are equal. It's a little difficult without any way to weigh them, but we heft them in our hands, and it doesn't take us long. Clearly, math and logic are universal between our two species. Maybe universal among any intelligent species. I don't know. We continue on, coming eventually to a branch in the path with 2 forks with swaths of glyphs carved above them. This time, I'm the one who recognizes the puzzle type. It's a variation on the one where there are 2 guards standing in front of 2 tunnels. One always lies, one always tells the truth, but you don't know which is which. So when they both tell you there's death down their tunnel, you have to figure out which to believe. Jules mutters softly to himself as he translates the rows of glyphs beneath them. Their meanings change depending on context, he says, like kanji in Japanese, or a bunch of other Earth languages. He's trying to translate for puns in an alien language, as best I can tell. I hold my breath and try not to show my impatience, until finally he nods hesitantly at one tunnel. We move gingerly, ready to run or dodge if something shifts in the path. But it seems we've chosen correctly. The next few corridors are filled only with the typical pitfalls here and there, and my mind starts to wander, until I see Jules, just ahead of me, walking straight onto a pressure plate. I dart forward, grabbing at his pack and yanking backward with all my strength. I'm so much lighter than him that I only shift him a little, but it's enough. When the plate triggers, and a shower of head-sized boulders rains down, Jules and I are in a heap just beyond its edge. Half-dazed, Jules stares dumbly at the pile of rubble for a moment before groaning and rubbing at his head. I risk a glance at him and see again the exhaustion there. We haven't stopped moving since we ditched Liz and her cronies, and it's been at least a day. What little sleep we did get before our capture got cut short when they snatched us. And neither of us slept much the night they had us as their prisoners. Especially not Jules, bound as tightly to that boulder as he was. "We've got to stop," I gasp. Jules coughs, the dust from the rockfall settling in around us. "Liz." He's still prone, shaking his head. I know what he's saying. Liz's company managed to cross the chasm beneath the music puzzle, despite the bridge being destroyed. They rappelled down into the broken puzzle where we were camping so silently they didn't wake us. They'll find a way through that rock fall sooner or later, and we can't be within grabbing distance when they do. We'll hear them, I say, sounding more certain than I feel. They're going to have to tunnel through all that rock, and that'll take time. And they'll make a lot of noise when they break through. That kind of sound echoes, and we'll hear it. But we've already solved the other puzzles, cleared the way, and left a trail for them. If they do get through the rockfall, all they'll have to do is catch up to us. I swallow hard. It's like he's speaking my own fears aloud. I know. But Jules, look at you. You were 2 seconds away from being a pancake. Look at me. I was half asleep. I could have just as easily not even seen that plate. We got lucky. And I don't know if you've noticed, but our luck hasn't been all that great so far. I don't want to count on it. We need sleep. We need time with the breathers. Even if you could force yourself to keep moving, if you don't get some oxygen, you won't be able to think straight. Jules lets his breath out, then slowly drags himself into a more upright position.
Mais Hercule,
he mutters, one of his incomprehensible curses. You're right, he concedes finally. Looks like another chamber up ahead. If it's safe, we can stop there. I can see the darker hole he's indicating through the gloom. The chambers themselves, the ones containing puzzles, all share similar doorway-like entrances with carved rims like a warning, whereas the connecting corridors of tunnels seem more like simple passageways from one room to the next. I drag myself to my feet and offer Jules a hand, but he waves me away and stumbles up on his own. The shape I'm in right now, I wouldn't have been much help to him anyway. But the gesture just serves to remind me of what's changed between us. We inch our way toward the next chamber, on alert. Pausing at its entrance, Jules gazes around, searching for the glyphs of warning and explanation that have marked each puzzle room before. There are none. The walls and ceiling are completely and utterly bare. The floor is empty. No paving stones or pressure plates or pits. There are no carvings, no paintings, no glimmers of metal or crystalline rock. No shadowy cables in the ceiling. Nothing. Nothing but an empty room. Its only feature is another archway at its far edge. But instead of darkness on the other side of it, it contains a sheet of rock, carved with the most complex glyphs we've seen yet. If it's a door, it's not one with an obvious keyhole. This chamber is totally different from any other we've seen so far. And though I don't know what it means, Jules doesn't need to tell me to be careful. We both move forward slowly, gingerly, waiting for the catch. But we reach the center of the room without incident. And after tapping at the stone around us, then stomping on it, then, finally, jumping up and down on it, Jules drops his pack wearily to the ground. I guess it's safe. We can look at those carvings after we've slept. You think it means something? That this room is so different from the others? I can't be sure, he says. But we must be very close to the center now. Whatever's significant about this temple, whatever the Nautilus is warning us against, I think it might be on the other side. His gaze snags on the door, and I feel that same pull toward it. All this way, and our prize is finally within our grasp. All the more reason to sleep, I make myself say. If there's some kind of test coming, let's give ourselves a fighting chance. Jules nods slowly.
Mais Hercule, I'm exhausted.
I let my pack slide from my shoulders too, and sink to the stone floor. What does that mean? You keep saying it. One of your languages? He looks mildly embarrassed. It's, Latin. By Hercules. We'd catch it bad from our teachers if we were caught cursing, so I guess we just got creative. I eye him sidelong, not sure whether to laugh or cry or collapse in exhausted hysterics. Every time I think you can't get more... But I'm not sure what the word is that I'm searching for. More jewels is what I mean. He's the most jewels-ish person I've ever met. We both fall silent as we settle on the floor. It's frigid to the touch. But I'm so tired, I'm ready to sleep right there, cheek pressed to its chilly rock surface. But though my body's screaming for sleep, my mind knows at least part of the exhaustion comes from lack of food and lack of oxygen. So I force myself to open my pack and start sorting through it. It's a good thing they were lazy and made us carry our own stuff. I break the quiet. The meager light from my wrist LED throwing shadows around the gear in my bag and confusing my tired eyes. They took the wave stove, comes Jules' reply from the gloom a distance away. No hot meals for us anymore. I physically flinch at that reminder. Something hot in my stomach would have been like a ray of light in the endless night of this underground labyrinth. Trying not to sigh too loudly, I dig out my breather. I slip its strap into place and suck in a few lungfuls of richer air. I know all it's doing is injecting a little extra oxygen into Gaia's thin air. But it makes such a difference, I imagine myself dizzy with the sudden influx. I can hear Jules sorting through his own pack, see his headlamp moving this way and that in the dark. I pull out my blanket roll and a few protein bars, then crawl toward him. He's setting up his lantern, pulling his flashlight apart so it casts a yellow glow around the empty room. Then he switches off his helmet and tucks it beside his pack. He's deliberately set up the lamp between him and me, and he's pulled out his little journal and pencil, fumbling with it in his tiredness as he tries to grip it to write. Drawn back to his translations as if he can't help himself, doggedly continuing to work as if somehow it might save us, prepare us for whatever's on the other side of the door. I try not to shiver at the thought of sleeping alone on this cold stone. I toss him one of the protein bars, and it hits the floor and skitters to a halt against his leg. He doesn't react. Eat, I say, my voice distorted by the breather mask in place around my nose and mouth. Not hungry, he replies shortly, dropping his head into his hands. My mind's working so sluggishly that it takes me a few moments before I understand why his voice sounds so different from mine. At least put your breather on, I suggest. You'll be hungrier after your blood's got more O2 in it. He looks up wordlessly, eyes meeting mine for a second before sliding away toward his pack. Then I figure it out. When I negotiated with Liz, my only demand, apart from not being shot in the face, was that we get our breathers back. I got to see mine put back in my pack. But Jules, I was so busy trying to avoid the accusation and his stare that I never saw what they did with